Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Okay, I hope this is coming through clearly here. A little problem with the system on my side, probably. So I'm just going to proceed, unless I'm told otherwise, that I'm not coming through loud and clear. Okay, lots of news this past week in the economy to talk about. Lots of news, both U.S. and global. What are some of the topics that we need to address? Well, and the U.S. side, very clearly, what we've got going is further negotiations on these two fiscal stimulus bills. One, the reconciliation bill, as it's called, the $3.5 trillion here, and the infrastructure bill has already been agreed to, which is roughly $550 billion of new money. They say it's $1.2 trillion, but that's because they're doing smoke and mirrors and bringing in bills they already agreed to and authorized and simply adding it. And what we really have is $550 billion. And, of course, we have $3.5 trillion here proposed, but that's already being a rollback. And I'll talk about that when we get to that topic of the fiscal spending bills here. Also, this past week's important moves, developments by the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Central Bank, indicating its policy going forward. We'll talk about that. We have the U.S. economy, and we have latest data here from what's called the Purchasing Managers Indexes. This is activity by purchasing managers in manufacturing and services, which is generally used as an indication of the trend and direction of the U.S. economy here in the previous month. And what we got is a pretty sharp downturn. Slowdown here of the growth rate, which corroborates my view that we have a rebound going since the spring, but the rebound's going to dissipate here by the fourth quarter, which is very contrary to most mainstream economists who are saying, oh, the economy's fine and it's accelerating, it's going to continue to grow, blah, blah. Well, I'm not of that school, but we'll get to that topic. What I want to talk about first, though, is China. All right. Also, this past week, we saw a lot of fear factor growing among U.S. investors over this company in China called Evergrande. Evergrande is a big investor in construction, residential and commercial construction, the housing sector, whatever, in China. Housing sector in China drives a lot of China real investment, but it gets overloaded, has been for years, in accumulating debt to finance that growth in housing in China. And Evergrande is a company, one of the big players in the housing market there in China, and it took on an awful lot of debt. Huge amount of what we call leverage. Leverage means debt, right? Loaded up with debt, issuing bonds, corporate bonds, right? Now, you got to understand, why are U.S. investors in the market so jittery over Evergrande? It's because they have bought these bonds of Evergrande. Evergrande, being overloaded with debt, was issuing its bonds, almost $100 billion, at a higher interest rate. It would pay more for investors who bought it. U.S. speculators, investors, hedge funds, and others were searching for yield, as they say. In other words, looking for investments that paid high interest rates. And so, Evergrande looked good for that, and they invested heavily in Evergrande. And it looked like Evergrande now in trouble, and there was a question until a day or so ago whether China would bail out Evergrande. and therefore keep these American hedge fund and other investors whole here, so that they would not have losses. If Evergrande defaulted on their bonds, meaning they would stop paying the interest that they had promised when they issued these bonds, right? Then the bonds would have been worthless. A default, right? Would have been worthless. And the big U.S. hedge funds and other investors, professional investors, who piled into Evergrande bonds would take losses, right? This is how contagion spreads from one financial company or sector to another, you see, because they're all connected here by a web of credit, of loans made that goes back even to, you know, the main commercial banks, right? The hedge funds and others, equity firms borrow from the commercial banks, meaning the Bank of America, Citi, you know, J.P. Morgan, Wells, and so forth. The big commercial banks loan money to the hedge funds and others. And they then use their money to buy these risky financial securities, in the case of Evergrande's corporate bonds, right? And so when a default occurs, as an Evergrande risk, then those bonds that were bought are worthless, and they have to write off as a loss. The hedge funds have to write off as a loss. And if there is too much of that, then you know, it stretches back to the commercial banks. Well, that's what happened in 2008-09. The losses, of course, were in the U.S. subprime mortgage bonds at that time and derivatives written on those mortgage bonds. You know, it was like a double crisis. When those losses occurred, the losses had to be recorded by those who loaned money to these other financial institutions to buy these bonds, in the case of Lehman Brothers, remember, right? Invested heavily late in the U.S. housing market. And when the housing market bonds bellied up, well, Lehman had the losses and couldn't get any more loans to cover the losses. And Lehman went under. And when it went under, others went under. And the same thing with AIG, the insurance company, and, you know, Washington Mutual and Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, all those players, even the auto companies that were speculating in housing had problems. But the idea is contagion, you see. And in the global capitalist economy, there's a lot of connections and credit between companies and institutions. And when one falls and defaults, if it's an important one, it goes, it spreads, the contagion spreads. And boy, does it spread fast. So that was the worry here this past week. Evergrande, was China going to let Evergrande go under? If it did, what was going to happen to the hedge funds and other investors in the U.S. that had piled into Evergrande's bonds, corporate bonds, right? They would have to take a loss. And who knows where that would go. And so the market got jittery over that. And we saw, you know, some a big stock, Dow, U.S., S&P, whatever, collapse. Well, I wouldn't say collapse, but a contraction, significant contraction, right? Worries over that. And worried at the same time of what the Fed was going to announce last week about whether it was going to start raising rates. Those two things together were a big worry. As it turned out, you know, the Fed said, no, don't worry, guys. We're not going to raise rates too fast here. Don't worry about that. You know, maybe in November, December, we'll start token retreat on our $120 billion every month of free money injections into the banks and the investors. You know, we'll start a token retreat on that maybe in December. That's not going to affect that much, you know. But and as far as raising interest rates more aggressively, we won't even start doing that until the middle of next year of 2022. So, you know, the stock market investors said, oh, okay, that's cool. You know, nothing imminent here. Nothing going to happen to upset our financial apple cart. Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Powell. Thank you, Fed. Keep the money flowing, you know, and we'll keep redirecting the free money into the financial markets where we get rich as hell and keep that going. And we're not worried because there's no such thing as a financial transaction tax in the U.S. that would tax our super profits here from financial asset markets, right? That's not even in the fiscal bills. The Fed, both the Fed and it looked like China, kind of looked like China, we don't know really yet, would backstop Evergrande. And therefore, the stock markets went right back up. You see, they got two nice pieces of news here. The Fed taper and rate hikes was nowhere around the corner. And the Evergrande thing looked like it would not result in a serious contagion effect for the U.S. Investors that piled into that risky, high interest rate debt issued by Evergrande. But putting the Evergrande thing in a bigger context here, you know, what China is now doing is trying to rein in its speculators and rein in this financial side running amok in its economy. Because they see it generates a great income inequalities. And in China has, as well as in the U.S. And, you know, China and President Xi has a new policy here of trying to get back to a more socialist kind of an economy. And you can't do that with runaway income inequality. And if you want to do something about income inequality, you got to do something about the financial speculators in China. And hence, you know, that eventually gets to a policy of, look, we got to rein in the speculators who are taking on all this excess debt like Evergrande and making themselves rich here. And we got to start building houses for use. For people who need it, not building houses to speculate in it, which is what's going on with Evergrande and a lot. China's been fighting the financial speculators at least since 2015, when the same guys precipitated a bubble in China's stock market that bust and caused significant financial instability event in China when its stock market crashed. Well, ever since then, China has been trying to rein in the speculators, particularly in the housing sector, where you always find speculators really wallowing in the mud. You know, housing really attracts the speculators in its very nature. And they've been trying to rein them in, and the institutions behind them that are speculating, not just in housing, but in, you know, other financial asset markets in China. This has been a kind of a on-again, off-again effort by the Chinese Communist Party and the government there to somehow rein in these speculators in housing in particular. And China's been going through bouts of that. You know, they try to go after the speculators, but because they're in housing, going after the speculators in housing usually slows the growth in housing, slows the real economy to some extent, and then China backs off and goes for more growth, which leads to more speculation and debt. And then it comes back and tries to do it again. It's been doing this whack-a-mole thing with speculators in housing and other financial markets in China on and off since at least 2015. And what you got with Evergrande is China let Evergrande go to the brink, you know, to the edge of the cliff here as a kind of a warning You know, it was questionable whether it would bail them out, and it still is questionable. Kind of a warning to the rest of the speculators in the housing sector here to beware. Now, also, another example of that, let's target these speculators because they not only cause income inequality problems, but they destabilize the economy from the financial side. China is going after the cryptocurrency boys. You know, cryptos were a big player in China, a lot of the mining, of cryptos occurs in China, and a lot of the trading and so forth. But they've been cracking down. The Chinese have been cracking down on the crypto market, and they came up with another announcement this past week, almost totally regulating the industry. You know, or kicking out some of these players out of the country, right? A real significant regulatory push to get rid of cryptos. They're quite worried that this whole crypto thing can build to a significant level and destabilize the economy. It's still in its early phase. You know, it's about a $2 trillion market. The threat is that it will grow much larger, and we see very, very great price volatility in this market, which is just an invitation to financial bubbles and crashes going on in it. So China is cracking down on the cryptos earlier. China Central Bank has already issued its own digital currency. You see, cryptos are digital currencies, right? It's issued its competing own government digital currency as one way of, crowding out the independent capitalists speculating in cryptos, which is a trend that's going to have to happen. You know, technology is changing, and you got this blockchain technology that enables cryptocurrencies and transactions. The big risk of cryptos, one of the big risks, is not just general financial instability, but displacing the money supply. You know, if you have private sources able to create money, digital money in this case, what you're doing is taking away the central bank's control of the money supply, which is important to regulating stability in the capitalist economy. And that's true in China. You know, central bank there, People's Bank of China, PBOC, and the Fed in the U.S., and the European Central Bank, Bank of England, etc., right? All of these central banks are going to have to issue their own digital currencies. If they hope to control the money supply, right? They know that. If they don't, then the private creation of money through cryptocurrencies will pretty much take away that lever of control of the economy. The central banks will lose control of the money supply, the total money supply, as cryptos grow, and therefore their policies, controlling interest rates and so forth, they won't be able to control the capitalist economy. It'll become a Wild West show like it was in the 19th century before central banks really took control of the money supply. You see, when we created the Federal Reserve in 1913, one of the important measures was that the central bank had control of the currency. Up until then, individual banks would create their own dollars. We had hundreds of different kinds of dollars, U.S. dollars, in the 19th century. Banks would create their own dollars. You know, there was a dollar of the Bank of Richmond, there was a dollar of the Bank of Savannah, whatever. So when we created the central bank, it was all about centralizing in the government the creation of money, the money supply. And that's what we've had ever since. The last vestige of that was in 1935, when the government said, well, you can't use gold coins for buying and selling things anymore. Turn in your gold coins and we'll give you Federal Reserve notes, right, from the bank. It's not legal tender anymore. So, you know, gold was being used as for transactions even after the Fed was created in 1913. There was still a lot of gold coins circulating around. So to that extent, the Fed did not have total control of the money supply, even though it was now issuing dollars. That last vestige of lack of control of the money supply was pulled into the Fed here in 1935, right? But now you got a break from that with cryptocurrencies, right? You got private sectors, in other words, crypto miners, creating currency in the form of, you know, coins, virtual coins, Bitcoin, whatever, right? Ethereum and whatever. And this is a big threat to the central banks. They can't have this, you see. They can't lose – capitalist economy cannot lose control of influencing the money supply. I mean, technology and globalization has undermined the control, the Fed control of the money supply. It can't really influence very much long-term rates, just short-term rates for you know, Federal Reserve bills and notes. It has no control of long-term interest rates through the money supply, but still has some control over the short-term rates. But if you let the independent capitalist speculators, wild westers, create money at will here with cryptos, you're going to lose control of the money supply. That's why the central banks are all now creating their own digital currencies and moving towards heavily regulating these private crypto coins and taxing these crypto coins, right? Well, the PBOC, the China Central Bank, is way out ahead of all of them. It already is using its own digital currency. The Fed's just talking about it, right? And now the crackdown on the cryptos through this ban, crypto bans, Coinbase and so forth, is part of this whole process, right? It's part of the process of bringing to heel the capitalist financial speculators who are deeply embedded now in the China economy as that economy has integrated itself in the last several decades into the global capitalist economy. That has been positive for China in that money capital has become available from the West, the U.S. particularly, right, has flowed into China to finance its real economy growth. Mm-hmm. But now the money capital has also been flowing in the last decade to fuel these financial speculators in China. Well, you got a crackdown going on now. Xi and the Communist Party are saying, okay, this has gone too far. We may lose control of it, of our money supply, which we don't want to. You know, let these other capitalist economies in the U.S. and Europe play Russian roulette with the crypto guys, right? But we're not going to do it. We're not going to take that risk of financial instability. Because we saw what they did in 2015 to us. Whoa, that was a big, we peered over the cliff here of financial instability. We don't want to do that again. We're going to nip it in the bud here, right? And that's how you got to see what China's doing, both with the crypto ban here going announced and with the signal to the speculators in the housing sector with this case of Evergrande in housing, you know. Is Evergrande a layman moment, some have asked. No, I don't think so. I think it's China giving a signal to the rest of the speculators, you guys pull back. Your days are numbered. We're watching you close. And, you know, China has been cracking down on these new technologies, too, you know, like social media and so forth. Jack Ma and the others, big tech capitalist over there. Xi has announced what looks like an attempt to turn back, retreat from this headlong dive into the global capitalist economy. They're worried about the instability, financial and global, that might bring to China. They're worried about the income inequality accelerating as a result, you know, from financial investments, speculation. There's a problem with shadow banks appearing in China. Shadow banks are just unregulated financial institutions that take big risks, you see, and destabilize the economy, create bubbles. There's concern with that. They haven't really tamed the shadow bankers since 2015. But it's, you know, a lot of it's the income inequality that financial asset investment brings that's so evident that, you know, quietly simmers popular discontent with the great inequalities going on. The inequality is driven largely by financial assets and speculation in financial assets, financial profits, and by tax laws that do not touch those financial profits, you see. That's where investors in the top 0.1% make most of their income gains, right? Where most of their wealth comes from. It's from the financial side. It's not from making and selling things. That still goes on, you know. You got technology stuff. You got Apple iPhones. You've got software, et cetera, here from technology side. That's still the real economy. But parallel to it and even more profitable are the financial side of the economy. And that's where the capitalists, the 0.1%, make their big profits. And that's why you got this running inequality game. At the same time, of course, wages, real wages, don't grow very much. So wages are stagnant at best. So if you got the working class stagnant income growth for 20, 30 years, and you got the capitalist class, particularly the financial speculators, growing by leaps and bounds every year for 20 years, well, what you're going to get is growing inequality, you see? And then what you do is you make sure the tax system favors the capitalist corporations and wealthy investors, right? You make sure that that happens so that they can, the corporations can distribute to their shareholders a big lion's share of everything that they make. You know, that's why we run over $1 trillion a year in just the Fortune 500 companies distributing dividends and stock buybacks to their shareholders. You know, that's why we have $1 trillion plus every year for the last decade. And this year, by the way, is going to be estimated to be around $1.5 trillion distributed by buybacks and dividend payouts. You know, it's a big conduit. It's a big funnel of money going to wealthy investors, the 0.1%, you see. That's another major source of the income inequality, right? Well, China sees this in the West and says, ideologically, they've turned their ear away as they've developed, but now they're quite well economically developed, and they say, no, this is dangerous for social stability. And of course, it runs totally counter to their socialist ideology. So to sum up, you know, you've got to look at what's going on in China, both with Evergrande and both with the crypto ban and the social media companies ban, as an attempt to, as part of this policy of let's turn towards more income equality, because inequality is pretty serious in China as well as the U.S. here. Capitalism naturally develops the inequality. It's a natural consequence. It's a consequence of it. You can't avoid it. It's always going to create that inequality, especially since it's become financialized. The inequality is accelerated because the wealth and income generated from financial assets is so much greater than from making things, you see. So it's part of a growth shift as well. China saying where our growth model is not going to rely so much on housing and construction materials for housing. We want to turn more to households and consumers, and a fear of a market crash down the road from all this speculation going on. And that's, you know, cryptos as part of that. Okay. So that was important news this past week. The crypto ban, the Evergrande default issue here that was reverberating in the West here, because you had a lot of U.S. investors that are in China, that are in its housing market, particularly financial investors from the U.S. You know, part of China's dealing with Trump was to agree to allow U.S. financial institutions to have a majority ownership of their operations in China for the first time, right? So that means they have even more, U.S. and Western investors, financial investors, banks, and so forth, have even more potential for stimulating the financial markets, right? Lending to financial speculators in China, or doing it themselves. So the Chinese, even though they opened up their economy further to Western finance, they're taking other measures to try to get a control on that, so it's not just a runaway. Okay, so that's an important thing with to note here about what happened this past week with China. Back to the Federal Reserve, and then to this reconciliation bill. As I mentioned already, the Fed news was an important economic event this past week. What the Fed did was to say, all you guys getting $120 billion in us a month, under the cover that, we got to prevent a crisis in the banking system, you know. That's what they did. They started that in March 2020, right? Started pumping $120 billion and other means here in other channels into investors, into the banks, into speculators. And that's number one reason why the stock market has just kept going, you see, throughout this real crisis where the real economy has contracted and 35% of the workforce at some time or another has been unemployed, right? And we know the impact on the real economy here. Maybe a million small businesses have gone under. We don't know how many workers have been jobless for how long. We just know a lot of them have come through the unemployment ranks, and renters, of course, being evicted, et cetera. The real economy has suffered. You know, service industry, small businesses really suffered here in the real economy. But the financial side, the markets, as they say, did quite well. You know, they just blew right through this thing as if there was nothing happening. And in fact, they hit records. Well, why? Why did they hit records? Where did they get the money to keep pumping up the markets, stock markets? Well, they got it from the Fed. Originally, it comes from the Fed, you see. The Fed loans to banks. Banks loan to speculators and speculate themselves. In other words, buy stocks and bonds and derivatives and so forth, you know. And the money's all diverted going into these markets. And very little of it from the Fed actually gets into the real economy. Some of it, some of it does. But increasingly in 21st century capitalism, it gets redirected into financial markets. keeps those markets going, you see. That's why I've always said, you know, my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes, 2017, that, you know, the Federal Reserve monetary policy is really about subsidizing financial investors and big capitalists. It's not about stabilizing the economy. I mean, look, the banks were not in trouble in 2020. They were not in trouble, unlike 2008-9. They were not in trouble. Big corporations were in trouble. They were hoarding record levels of cash. And yet the central bank, the Fed, starts pumping $120 billion in QE every month into the banks when they didn't need it. We bailed out the banks when they didn't need to be bailed out. We pre-bailed out the banks. And we just kept the money going every month. And the Fed added $4 trillion to its debt because of all that. $4 trillion. That's at least as much in 2020 that, you know, the U.S. government added to its debt. So, you know, there's really two economies here, not just the financial and the real economy. There's the Federal Reserve that keeps the financial side, you know, flush with free money, cash, right? And then there's the real side of the economy, how, you know, households and businesses that aren't financialized. And, you know, they got to go begging the Congress when they're in trouble, like last year. For funds to keep them afloat. I mean, contrast that. Think of that, right? You got one side of the capitalist economy throwing all this free money at those who don't need it so they can become super rich. And then you got the other side of the economy where people think about, oh, this is the economy, you know, which is the real side of the economy where businesses provide services to people or make things that people buy, right? Real things that require manufacturing or construction. So you got to hire real people and pay them a real wage and give them an income to buy the stuff. That's the real economy. But, you know, where the real money's made is on the financial side. And it's like a tale of two economies going on in this country. And the one is kind of obfuscated. People don't really understand what's going on over there with the Fed and the markets, right? They only kind of understand that, okay, we need some spending on infrastructure, we need some spending on childcare and so forth, right? That's the one that they kind of understand and can see. That's what hits the news, daily news, you know, unemployment benefit claims and so forth. But there's really two economies, and one is enriching the rich at record levels, and the stock price appreciations are at record levels through this tremendous contraction of the real economy that we've experienced and we're barely climbing out of. You know, we have a little rebound going on as the real economy opens up. But we got real problems in that real economy as well. I mean, unemployment claims now are sort of inching back up, right? We've got inflation, which is much higher than the reporting because we have supply problems. You know, COVID accelerated the contraction. The economy, the real economy, was heading for a slowdown at the end of 2019 anyway. It may have hit a recession in 2020 or maybe 2021 for sure, right? But COVID accelerated and exacerbated that already heading for a recession trend in 2019. The economy in 2019 toward the end, you know, just about stalled out. You know, not a good time to hit it with COVID, right, and shut it down. The point there being that COVID is not the cause of this. It's the cause of the exacerbation and a deep contraction, deeper than would have been normal, right? But it's not the cause. And therefore, getting COVID under control is not going to end the problem, you see? It will bring us back to the no-growth scenario. Now, this year, you know, GDP and growth, you know, will be 4 or 5% maybe. Well, that's because of the reopening of the economy. How much of that growth is due to reopening the economy and how much of that growth is due to fiscal stimulus is the question. Well, the stimulus bills of last year have been exhausted and dissipated. We're almost at the end of the stimulus from the February bill, you know, the COVID relief bill, as it's called, or American Rescue Plan. Right, we're almost at the end of that stimulus, and we really need a robust follow-on stimulus that creates jobs, you see. But we're not getting that. We're not getting that from the infrastructure bill. As I said, only $550 billion of new actual spending, and that won't take effect until middle-late next year. That won't hit the economy for at least another 9 to 12 months. And then we got the debate over the reconciliation bill. This is the $3.5 trillion human infrastructure investment, Build Back Better bill, whatever the hell you want to call it. Originally, it was called American Families Plan, right? This is the improvement in child care, in free education, in elderly care, in Medicare improvements, right? Climate change investment, and other measures. $3.5 trillion. When he was running for office, you know, Biden said, "Oh, we got to go big," because he knew Obama did not go big, and what resulted from that Obama minimalist stimulus was a 5 to 6 year drag on the economy. Sluggish, slow growth. Jobs did not come back for 5 years. 6 years to 2015 to levels before the recession, because Obama didn't go big. He listened to Larry Summers. And, you know, so Biden knew this. The Democrats knew this, you know, and because Obama didn't go big, they lost control of Congress. And we know what happened after that. Right. And you got to see the Trump phenomenon as a consequence of failure to go big. And a failure of the Obama stimulus. So Biden comes in, you know, and he runs for election. He says, "Look, we're, you know, we got to go big." Yeah. And out of the block, you know, they passed this emergency thing called the American Rescue Plan, COVID plan in February. Okay. That puts a floor under the collapse. You know, because we were heading for a double dip recession here early this year, very clearly. That was the signal in the fourth quarter of last year. Watch out for first quarter. We're going for, you know, double dip here. But they staved it off with passing what's called the consolidation bill, $866 billion at the end of December last year, which pretty much just extended the loans for small businesses and unemployment benefits for workers and gave another token check, $300. Stimulus check to people under $75,000 a year. Okay, so, you know, that prevented the bottom from falling out. And then Biden comes in and, you know, they pass this bill to quickly provide some more money. And we've been living off of that, you see, living off of those two temporary stimulus measures. Which really aren't stimulus. You see, if it doesn't generate long-term sustained growth, it's a mitigation bill. Mitigation means prevent it from getting worse, not, you know, push it into sustained recovery. Well, as that was beginning to dissipate, and now it's pretty much dissipated, we've got the reopening of the economy a second time this summer, overlaid on top of those bills. So as those bills, fiscal bills, you know, American Rescue Plan and the consolidation bill of last December, as their effects wane, we've got the reopening of the economy. It looks like, oh, well, we're recovering. And, you know, when you shut down much of the economy and reopen, you're going to get a big boost just from the reopening, right? But the reopening will give you a rebound. You see, not a sustained recovery. You need to add to that significant fiscal stimulus, not monetary stimulus, because that money just goes into the markets, right? Most of it. But a fiscal stimulus. Well, that's what's going on now, this debate, the fiscal stimulus bills, the infrastructure bill, and the reconciliation bill. You know, will these pass, particularly the latter reconciliation bill, because this effects will occur in the economy sooner than the infrastructure bill. You won't see that this year. So the key to jumpstarting the rebound from the reopening into a sustained recovery is, can you pass a significant reconciliation bill? Well, it looks like they can't. I've been tweeting about this all week long, what's going on. You can find me at Dr. Jack Rasmus if you want to follow my tweets, you know, several a day, following negotiations going on in the back rooms in Congress. Not that I'm in the back room, but, you know, it leaks come out and so forth. And what we got here is Pelosi has linked the two bills in the House, saying, oh, we can't have one without the other. And that was the agreement, by the way, linking the two votes on infrastructure and reconciliation, linking them. We can't, you know, we're going to pass them both at the same time. That was the way you got Sanders and the progressives to agree to strip out the human infrastructure investment measures in the original infrastructure bill and pair that original infrastructure bill down from $2.3 trillion to only $550 billion in new money, you see, and no tax increases to pay for it, you see. That's how they've come to this agreement on the infrastructure bill, which is really a minimal. They stripped out all the human infrastructure so they wouldn't have to raise taxes to pay for it. You know, you get it down to $550 billion. You know, you can use smoke and mirrors on revenue to pay for it, which they've done. No tax hikes, really. No reversal of the Trump tax cuts, that, especially to pay for the infrastructure bill. And they got a tentative agreement on that, right? But, you know, clearly the leadership of the Democratic Party and Biden and, you know, got Sanders and the progressives to agree to strip out the human infrastructure from the original infrastructure bill and throw those measures into what was called a very vague proposal called American Families Plan, and call that the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill. And the agreement was, okay, we're going to take that, those measures, proposals, programs, out of the infrastructure bill, put it in what we'll call a reconciliation bill, Build Back Better bill, whatever the hell you want to call it, right? And we'll make sure we vote on them both at the same time. So Sanders and the progressives said, okay, long as you're going to vote on them both at the same time, you know, we'll go along with stripping it out of the infrastructure bill and putting it in this new repackaged thing called the reconciliation bill. Okay, and but you got to vote on them both at the same time. Okay, we'll go along with that strategy. So that's where we are, you see. And now the question is, will they vote on them at the same time? Will they? One without the other. Maybe in the House. Maybe. Right? But certainly not in the Senate. Certainly not in the Senate. I've been predicting on Twitter here that they will eventually vote on them separate. They will pass through the infrastructure bill, but the reconciliation bill, $3.5 trillion, is another question. They may not, unless they slash the hell out of it and reduce it to what Manchin, Joe Manchin, Senator from West Virginia, says, oh, I might accept a $1 to $1.5 trillion for the reconciliation bill. You see, because he's holding it up. He and his colleague there, Senator Sinema from Arizona, big phony opportunist, Sinema, And those two are holding it all up in the Senate. Because in the Senate, the Democrats need every Democrat to vote, and then 50 of them, and then, you know, to have, you know, Harris, who's the president pro tem of the Senate, to vote to break the tie. They need every vote. But Manchin is holding it all hostage. Manchin and Sinema holding it all hostage. But you got to understand, Manchin and Sinema are not individuals doing this on their own. They are the shills, the spokespersons for the corporate wing of the Democratic Party. Right? They're carrying the water for the corporate wing. The corporate wing does not want to raise taxes. They don't want to reverse the Trump tax cuts any more than McConnell and his Republicans want to reverse it. You see, this is about taxes, see, and protecting the Trump tax cuts. This is the real negotiations behind all the negotiations on these social spending programs, right? If you cut these programs, you don't have to raise taxes, right? But if you leave them in place, you're going to have to raise taxes on the rich, on the corporations. So you can't separate out the tax negotiations from the actual spending infrastructure and the human infrastructure reconciliation proposals. They're two sides of the same coin. And it's the corporate wing of the Democratic Party that's trying to pare down the actual spending program so they don't have to reverse the Trump tax cuts to pay for them. That's really what this is about. And this past week, you know, Joe Biden called them all into his office there. You know, he called in, quote, they're called moderates, you see. Manchin and Sinema are called moderates. No, this is the corporate wing of the Democrats, right? They're not moderates. And then we got the progressives, you know, Sanders and Warren's in the Senate and the Progressive Caucus in the House, right? And he called them all in separately. You know, he called in the moderates and then talks to them and then calls in the progressives. And then he huddles with Pelosi and Schumer. And Pelosi and Schumer come out of the meeting and say, oh, we're very pleased with this. Mm-hmm. What are they so pleased about? I don't think Manchin and Sinema caved in. What are you so pleased about? You know, I think they got a, they're talking about a new formula to, of smoke and mirrors here for the reconciliation bill, just as they did smoke and mirrors for the infrastructure bill. You know, they say, oh, it's $1.2 trillion. It's really only $550 billion, and there's no tax hikes to pay for it, you see. That's what they want to get to on the reconciliation $3.5 trillion bill. Right? So they come out, you know, all happy face here, Schumer and Pelosi, and say, oh, we like what we got. Right. Well, what did they get? Well, they're not even telling the rest of their members in Congress what the deal is. No, they're holding in cards close to their chest. What I think is going to happen is this. I think they're going to come up with some kind of formula, you know, that they can say, oh, well, you know, we got most of our $3.5 trillion here, but most of it won't take any effect until 5 years from now, maybe. You know, it'll be a 10-year proposal. These are all 10-year proposals, right? So there won't be any real spending on key provisions, you know, like Medicare or education, you know, even maybe climate change, until 5 years into the bill. And then, you know, they'll have some tax hikes 5 years later into the bill when these new spending provisions come in. They'll backload it, right? Of course, 5 years from now, nothing's guaranteed, and as Republicans come in, they'll shoot the whole thing down. And they know that. They know that. So they'll be able to say, hey, look, you know, we got almost $3.5 trillion here, but you're not going to see any of that. It's all on paper. Mm-hmm. And in the short term, when we need it, there'll be some token spending that won't be paid for by taxes. Right? Or maybe some minimal taxes here and there. They'll borrow most of it. I think that's what's going to happen. I think they'll, but it's still a question of whether they're going to vote at both bills at the same time. I think the House may do it, but the Senate certainly won't do it. and the Senate will come up with its really stripped down version, and then the Senate and the House will have their joint meeting, conference committees, and then they'll hash out the real bill in conference, right? And the real bill will be backloaded. I think that's what we're going to see eventually here. And you got a process going on, right? Overlaid on top of this is the whole debt ceiling thing, right? Oh, we got to raise the debt ceiling now, $28.5 trillion, you know. What was the total national debt when George Bush came into office? $4 trillion. What was it when he left? Almost $9 trillion. What was it when Obama left? $17 trillion. What was it when Trump left? Well, $22 trillion, whatever. What's it going to be here after the end of all this spending, which stretches out, you know, over 10 years here? $28.5 trillion and rising, you know. By the way, there's no real debate going on in Congress over the raising the defense bill, the Pentagon bill, which is a subset of total defense spending. You know, Biden had asked for $750 billion. Well, Congress is agreeing to $780 billion. You know, you end a war and you raise war spending. That's the formula in the U.S. Ending wars doesn't mean, you save some money from spending. No, it means you're going to spend even more, right? So we're at $780 billion just for the Pentagon. Actually, defense spending is well over $1 trillion when you throw in all the other cubby holes that they stash in some of this stuff. I won't get into that. I've talked about that. But the debt limit is overlaid on this. You know, they got to raise it to $28 trillion. Republicans say they won't vote one of them to support it. Well, that has nothing to do with the new spending bills. You know, people think that the Republicans won't vote for it because, you know, we got all this $3.5 trillion. No, this is for stuff already spent that Republicans agreed to. You know, consolidation bill and all the other bills here during the COVID crisis. You know, they just don't want to spend, don't want to vote. They want the Democrats to take all the blame for this. They want to make a talking point for themselves here for the 2022 elections. That's all this is about, right? And this is the same old McConnell, Stonewall on everything, anything and everything when Democrats are in power, right? We've got this these two bills here that are going to get resolved, and overlaid on is the debt spending thing. They'll raise the debt ceiling. You know, none of them are going to, and the Republicans, as long as it looks like the Democrats can do it by themselves, they'll let them do it. But they'll raise the debt ceiling. That's not a problem. And it's really overdone about the risks, I think, of not meeting your debt payments here on treasuries. They come up with deadline dates, but there's other deadline dates behind this as well. Treasury has little funds here and there that can stretch it out by weeks, maybe even a month or so if they need to. So the world is not going to collapse. But it's interesting here, I end on this note, it's interesting that the debt ceiling issues always come up when we're looking at passing tax hikes or spending. You know, or tax cuts and spending, rather. You know, they always come up. In 2011, debt ceiling was an issue. Well, that forced Obama cut spending by $1.5 trillion. And in 2013, debt ceiling was another issue that forced Obama to agree to extend the Bush tax cuts for another decade at a cost of $5 trillion. So it only comes up when there's austerity, you see, around the corner. It's kind of a signal that we're heading for that as well. Okay. I think that does it for today. We will see next week. We'll see the details on these negotiations here in the House on the reconciliation bill, and probably have a show just talking about the details of that. So stay tuned next week for the show that is going to, the sideshow of negotiations in Congress will continue.